Looking for something new? Try fencing, the Olympic and Paralympic sport that mixes speed, strategy, and fun. It's like chess meets cardio. Quick feet, quick decisions, and a satisfying beep when you score a point. Kids, teens, and adults can start anytime. No experience needed, and many clubs have loaner gear. Coaches teach fundamentals and safety from day one. Find a beginner class near you at usafencing.org/tryfencing. That's usafencing.org/tryfencing.
All right, so check it out. You know how we talk about all the weird stuff they sneak into our food, our air, or even our clothes? Yeah, it turns out most shirts are basically made of plastic. You're sweating in chemicals, man. That's why I switched to Hypernatural. It's wild. They make their fabric from jade stone and crab shells. Yeah, you heard me right. Jade and crab shells. The jade keeps you naturally cool, like literally drops your skin temp down a few degrees. And the crab shell fibers, they fight odor and help your skin stay fresh all day long. So you can wear it longer, wash it less, and not smell like a dirty old gym towel. They use a fancy cotton, mother-of-pearl buttons, and zero junk. No polyester, no chemical dyes, and none of that synthetic garbage. It's clean, it's sustainable, and honestly, it's just cool gear. You can wear it anywhere, the gym, the range, whatever, and it looks legit. Go to hypernatural.com and use my code ZEROSIGNAL at checkout, and you'll get yourself 20% off. And get yourself the cleanest, most comfortable shirt you've ever worn. That's Hypernatural, nature engineered for comfort.
The views and opinions expressed by the guest in this episode are solely their own and do not necessarily reflect the views, positions, or endorsements of the host or Zero Signal podcast. Now let's get to the show. You're tuned into Zero Signal, a show about what they won't say and what you're probably already thinking. No fluff, no filters, no bullshit. Let's crack it open.
At this time, I'm going to ask you to fasten your seatbelt.
Welcome back to Zero Signal. I'm your host, David, joined as always by my brother, Jay. Tonight, we're stepping into a landscape shaped by revolutions, fallen empires, and the lingering shadow of the Cold War that never truly ended. A few people have spent more time charting that train than our guest tonight. Christine Lin is an historian and analyst with over three decades of experience studying Russia, the former Soviet Union, and the volatile relationship between Moscow and Washington. Her work has taken her across radio, television, and digital platforms, breaking down conflicts, decoding power structures, and reminding us that history isn't the past. It's the engine that is quietly driving today's conflicts. So, Christine, for our listeners meeting you for the first time today, who are you? And what drew you into the world of the Russian and Soviet history?
First of all, thank you, David and Jay. It's a pleasure to be here with you. It's a very important topic. That's why I appreciate it, your invitation to be on the show, because most Americans know virtually nothing about the Ukraine-Russia conflict. And it is precisely because they know nothing about the Soviet Union or Russia of today. And they have been subject to years of lying propaganda, which has been designed to secure their support for the U.S. position, for the U.S. military, for the U.S. grift, all the money that is being made. As with a lot of other conflicts in the world, this is a perfect example, a tragic one, of the result of the United States' aggression worldwide. I was drawn to this in particular as a historian and a researcher in my analysis because of my deep appreciation for Russia. Russia has made incredible contributions to science, advances, its society, its day-to-day life for the civilians. Is something that I have a very deep appreciation for. And as a historian, studying Russian history, Soviet history, and even prior to that has been fascinating. I've been drawn to it for many years, and it actually holds a very special connection that's kind of hard to explain to me. I love Russia and the Soviet Union, and this turbulent, tumultuous history for me has been fascinating. And in it, I find a beauty to see what the Russian Federation has become. And because of that, as a historian, truth is my highest priority. And I'd like your audience to know before we get into this discussion about the Ukraine-Russia conflict that I always rely on documented evidence, original sources whenever possible. For me, I have spent countless hours looking at declassified CIA materials, State Department documents. I rely a lot on Freedom of Information Act releases, policy papers like from the RAND Corporation, and I've done this for decades in terms of U.S. NATO aggression worldwide. And of course, due to my particular expertise in Russia and the Soviet Union, at this time, there's no more important topic I can address when I'm talking to the American public, because the U.S. has a history of covert operations. That's inside of Ukraine. Americans know nothing about that. A consistent pattern of disinformation to Americans, and the West in general has done this. There's a long-term strategy of the United States aimed at achieving the strategic defeat of Russia. And these operations go back for decades, and the narrative most Americans believe about this is the complete opposite of the historical truth about Soviet-American relations and certainly Ukraine-Russian conflict. We're talking about something where billions of U.S. taxpayer dollars are funding regime change, proxy wars, political intervention worldwide, and this one really touches my heart, and I'm going to share with you the facts, not the Western lying propaganda that's intended and has successfully deceived most of my fellow Americans. So I just thank you for having me, and I just want you to ask me anything in our discussion.
We're really excited to have you on the show. I know this is a controversial topic, but I also think it's a very important topic. As we talk about a lot of topics on our show, a lot of the times you find the truth somewhere in the middle. Like the media, the government's not always going to give you all the facts. And if you listen to the media, you might as well just jump on the first bus out of here because they're going to be lying to you. It's so important to get at the heart of it. I think a lot of people almost view, like, at one point in time, Russia was an ally of the United States. And now there is some type of competition that exists. Has that relationship always been controversial, or has it really soured post that Ukraine conflict?
Oh, no. The roots of the distrust between the United States, and I would include Britain, the UK, and Russia and the Soviet Union, it certainly didn't begin at all in 2022 when Putin began the military operation. It didn't, even as some of your, I would assume many of our audience is aware of the coup, that was Western coup, United States coup in 2014. It didn't even begin there, and we will get into those during our discussion, but absolutely not. I'd have to say that the roots of the distrust between the two nations goes back many decades. In fact, even during World War II, for example, was contemplating and drawing up actual military plans and discussing it with the United States to launch an attack on the Soviet Union. These discussions were going on even before World War II had end it. And these U.S. and U.K. military plans was referred to as Operation Unthinkable. Churchill even proposed the idea of dropping atomic weapons, which of course were not in existence with the U.S., but he would have liked to see them dropped upon Soviet cities, key cities. I would also say during that discussion, it was proposed that the Germans, the captured Germans and Nazi soldiers, including the SS, particularly notorious for their designated evil that they did during the Great Patriotic War, World War II, that they be armed and trained for an invasion immediately following World War II so that the Allies, the other Allies, would invade the Soviet Union, get them out of Poland. When you think about the distrust, the Russians have no reason to trust the United States at all. Churchill even spoke soon after the war, 1946, here in the United States, Missouri. Probably both of you are aware of it. Came to be known as the Iron Curtain speech. And that is when this, I would say, officially and publicly was announced to the American people, when Churchill actually said that an Iron Curtain has descended across the continent in Europe. And that was really the start of the, quote, Cold War. It started, and Truman, we remember, was sitting right next to him, obviously in sync with what he was saying. So this distrust goes back a long ways, even before World War II, and I won't get into even further history. But even during the Russian Civil War, the United States was involved by sending some, and we did have Americans die in that, fighting on the sides of what was called the Whites, fighting the Bolsheviks. And they brought in military and weaponry and ammunition. They have a very long history because, as I go back to my initial comment to you, the United States has always wanted the strategic defeat, be it the Soviet Union or be it Russia. And Russia took note of it immediately, even during World War II. too. They knew we were not actually allied countries. None of these countries believed that. The Cold War narrative is just false, and it is something that the United States was given to view the Soviet Union and later Russia as the enemy. The CIA itself was formed with a direct imperative to oppose the USSR. So no, there is nothing new about this, and there is absolutely nothing new about the conflict in Ukraine either, because the CIA has been operational in Ukraine for decades. There are a lot of key events that add to that, but they were training former Nazis soldiers in the U.S. and bringing them back afterwards and parachuting them into Ukraine decades ago. Most of them, of course, were quickly found and executed. But I'm saying the Russians have been aware of the U.S. plans against them. They have absolutely no illusions that the United States wants their strategic defeat. So nothing new here, but Ukraine is a key to it. And the United States has just been waiting for the time to be able, they thought, to weaken Russia and ultimately overtake Russia and divide it. These plans are well documented. I've read the documents where they actually discuss these things. While they're saying they want peace and cooperation, just like with Gorbachev, I think back to what, you know, and we'll talk about Ukraine in a moment, the NATO expansion. The Soviet Union was promised that there would be none. The Soviet Union was promised in terms of Germany. In fact, Soviet Union did not even want Germany to be divided east and west. Stalin actually spoke about it is wrong to divide a country and a peoples. There's no reason for that. But the United States knew at that time, along with the UK and France, that they wanted to use that as a springboard, as they later did in West Germany for military bases. No, there's so much distrust, and it really comes from the United States plotting against the Soviet Union and now Russia.
Yeah, I think of Russia, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but in my mind, there's like pre-Soviet Union, post-Soviet Union. And I think it all starts with Tsar Nicholas II when he got overthrown. Do you think that was a coup from the West, or do you think that happened naturally within the country?
No, I don't think the United States had any interest in the Tsar being overthrown. I would say that the roots of this emanated primarily in the people. Under the Tsar, very sadly, it was something like 80%, 90%, somewhere between 80 to 90% of the peasantry were living in dire poverty. Only the elites were living relatively well with basic provisions for one's life. There was a lot of anger in regards to the Tsar. There was also in terms of the management and mismanagement and the choice of conflicts, military conflicts, and that the Tsar had engaged the country in that many people were unhappy with and felt unnecessary. So there was a lot of suffering. Thus, when the Bolsheviks, and remember, the Bolsheviks came after the provisional government, and thereby a few months later, when the Bolsheviks saw that there was really a void there once the Tsar was no longer in power, then the Bolsheviks decided that this was the time to act and bring their government and their idea of a better government. In terms of the West involvement, I would say, came into it once the Bolsheviks had acquired the power and the governance. They definitely tried in working in the Civil War and with the whites against them, but they were unsuccessful. They had several hundred Americans die, and only then, but that amounted to nothing. And of course, the Bolsheviks, I think for the most part, had much support from the people because the people were suffering. Whenever you take a look at somebody, a power change like this happening, there's going to be both good and evil occur. But in terms of the ultimate governance of the Soviet Union, it increased tremendously for the people in the Soviet Union. Literacy went from practically nothing to the most literate country, upwards of 90% literacy. It started out, I think, at 20 to 30%, became the most literate country because Lenin really focused upon literacy, education, libraries. These are things most Americans aren't aware of. Food production, agriculture, all of those things actually improved for the lives of the day-to-day average person. It was not viewed. And if you listen to even in later years, in the 30s, the 40s, and after World War II, in the 50s and the 60s, and those who experienced that, if you spoke with them, many are deceased now, but if you had the chance to speak with them or listen listen to their interviews, many Soviet citizens and thereafter Russians look back on the Soviet Union with fondness, or at least with the appreciation that it did save the country. Frankly, I believe that if the Bolsheviks had not come to power in the Soviet Union, creating the Soviet Union, it would have been too weak a country to withstand what we now later see, the onslaught when they had to fight the German fascists. The country became much stronger after they took power militarily, economically, and socially.
So I want to ask a quick question, and then I want to get to the special military operation that's occurring today, because I think that's a matter that's close to a lot of our listeners' hearts. But if you were to break it down in layman's term, perhaps somebody that doesn't know a lot about Russia and the United States relations between the two countries, what would you say is the big baseline for the animosity or distrust or hate between the two countries? What does it ultimately come down to?
It comes down to the United States has never relinquished its goal that the Russian government is fully aware of their strategic defeat. And that I would have to tell you that every treaty, every agreement, every assurance that the United States has ever made to the, whether it was the Soviets or the Russian Federation thereafter, has been broken. It is not the other way around. Everything that I have seen the Russian Federation do in reference to the United States actually comes after much restraint, and then seeing that this other country, instead of wanting cooperation, because there has been good cooperation in the past between the countries, and there should be for humanity's sake, for exploration. There's so much that they can learn from together. And the Russians have continuously done that and shared much simultaneously while the U.S. has been plotting against them, with Ukraine, our subject today, being one of the primary areas that this aggression. I would say fundamentally it is due to the United States' hostility, covert and overt operations against the Russians, and that has never stopped, sadly.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's a great explanation. So how about we move along to Russia's special military operation? Obviously, Russia states it was because of, I think initially it was because of Nazis in Ukraine, but what ultimately started this war and why does it continue today? Has Russia achieved this objective?
They will. There's no doubt of that. Even from the very start, the very 22nd, 2022, when I listened to Putin's speech, and I have followed Putin's presidency since its inception. I listen to the Duma, their discussions, their laws. I read Russian newspapers almost daily, Russian television. I really keep a pulse on what is going on there. But before I can answer that question, I need to address something in your question. You had said that they had identified it as like a primary reason, and excuse me if I'm misquoting you, but you made reference as if that was one of the primary. You mentioned Nazis in Ukraine. And since you said that, I'm going to address it before I answer your full question there. That is not one of the primary initial reasons. I would say it was one of several, and it absolutely is true. I have studied these neo-Nazi fascist right sector groups that have been operating in Ukraine for decades. And again, the U.S. has covertly, the CIA, has been supporting them in Western Ukraine for many years. At the time of the disillusionment of the collapse of the Soviet Union, at that time, there were even votes across Ukraine and the other regions. And the vast majority, I forget the actual number, but it was an enormous number, had voted to remain with Russia, with the new Russia. And I think it was overwhelming, 70-80%. But in Western Ukraine, because of that, the fascist element there that was completely supported after World War II, the U.S. took them, trained them, and returned them to Ukraine. That is where all of these elements come from. It is a fact that there are, whether you refer to them as neo-Nazis, they certainly are covered in all of the Nazi symbols on their bodies. When they are taken as prisoners of war, if they're stripped of their shirts, their bodies are covered with Nazi symbolism. Even recently, they honor one of the Ukrainian Banderites, Stepan Bandera, we call them Banderites, with streets all through Ukraine are named after this Nazi who we know committed many atrocities during the war. So that element is definitely in Western Ukraine. I just wanted to digress for a moment since you had mentioned it. But it was only one of the reasons for this special military operation. First of all, I'm going to tell you, in terms of what my personal opinion of when Russia launched the special military operation, I was so relieved. As a historian, historian, I was acutely aware of, since the coup had occurred, that again was USA Western-backed coup in 2014, overthrowing the democratically elected. And when I say democratically elected, that election was actually overseen by international judges or evaluators at the time, proven to be well. But the United States did want it to be overthrown and put in someone to their liking, and they accomplished that. But when I heard about this, I was so relieved, because to me, the special military operation is the righteous action that Russia needed to take. If anything, and even the president of Russia has said this to some degree, it could have been done sooner. And the reason why Russians look at it that way, and I as a historian look at it that way, is because I was very much aware that since that coup between 2014 and 2022, when the SMO began, over 14,000 people, civilians, had been killed, had been murdered by the Ukrainian regime. And these are in the areas that people here discussed, okay? When we're talking about Ukraine, the regions that have ascended into Russia, voted by referendum, Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhzhia, these areas were in Ukraine. But remember, Ukraine was a very small region, and it was really because of the gifts, we'll say, of Lenin and later of Khrushchev, making this into the second largest country next to Russia in Europe. So these were originally all part of the Russian speakers, ethnic Russians, that bureaucratically became a part of Ukraine during the Soviet times. But these areas in Ukraine, Ukrainian citizens then, speak Russian. They're ethnically Russian. They have religious traditions that are Russian. But after that coup is exactly when, if you want to talk about the military conflict, began. And that is because the people in these places rejected the persecution that they immediately began receiving. They rejected this fake government installed by the United States. And because of that, what, they were systematically murdered. They were raped. And this is all verifiable. They were tortured. There were so many acts of terrorism on the civilian populations. And like I said, it ended up with militarily with the bombing, the shelling, constant shelling of civilians, that over 14,000 were dead. And these people had installed the puppet government. The West was being rejected by the people in Crimea and by the people in these regions because they were being persecuted, not allowed to speak Russian. The majority in Ukraine speak Russian. They speak it better than they do Ukrainian, okay? And they were being persecuted for their religion. So they revolted against this, and thus the military actions began. They were asking Russia to intervene for that entire 8 years. And that is the sad thing, that, you know, until Russia made the decision to intervene to protect these Russian speakers, Ukrainian civilians being murdered by their own government simply because they are Russian and identify with who they are and their ethnicity. Number two, of course, which we briefly touched upon earlier, is the encroachment of NATO. Now, it goes back to what you were talking about, the distrust. Many years, Putin, I remember back, I watched it in 2007, called the Munich Conference, where he employed the Western countries to come down to sensible relationship with Russia, because he had been trying repeatedly, believing the things that they were saying and then finding out that they would betray that. I would have to say that it finally came to a point where Putin and the Russian government realized the NATO encroachment. And when we talk about that, we're talking about all the countries previously, parts, regions of the Soviet Union. Immediately, the United States just came into there. After the coup, in fact, the CIA went straight into the Ukraine's SBU. That's their intelligence services. That was immediately. Within weeks, they actually set up an office, all right? Nothing covert at that time, except most Americans didn't know. They physically stationed in Kiev, okay? And what did they do? They directed the intelligence operations, as they are doing now. They conducted joint missions. Now, the whole Ukraine security services were essentially rebuilt under American supervision. So this has been a U.S. managed structure, CIA embedded. That is certainly one of the primary we're seeing. Russia wasn't going to allow the United States to have Ukraine join NATO and put missiles that could destroy Moscow within 5 minutes of its borders. And again, all of these things had been promised to Russia, Soviet Union, in years past that none of this would be happening. But I think that Putin and the government saw that after years of the United States encroachment and the breaking of all their promises, they had to do something. And also, I have to throw this in. There were so many attempts by Putin's government to avoid what we see happening now. And that is where the agreements Minsk 1 and Minsk 2, these were agreements, took place in Belarus. The first one in 2014 brought together Russia and the Ukrainian government, such as it was, and the leaders of these particular regions to just have a ceasefire, all right? Of course, I'm just telling you what sadly happens is the Ukrainians did not respect that. Minsk 2, though, was where we saw Angela Merkel and Holland of France come together and say that they would guarantee this peace agreement between Ukraine and Russia, and there would be a ceasefire, and that these regions would be respected, still part of Ukraine, but the attacks, the persecution, the destruction of their cities would cease, and they would be able to speak Russian again and attend their churches of choice. They would be respected. That was Minsk too. But as we all know, it was all a lie. And Angela Merkel has admitted it. Holland has admitted it. The Ukrainian president at the time, Western installed, has admitted it, that they only made Minsk too to dupe Russia into thinking that there was going to be peace so that they would have even more time to arm Ukraine. Okay, so the time came for Russia to do something about it. It is an existential threat for Ukraine to join NATO. It is also a threat to allow these weapons that are there now, as we see almost nightly attacks on civilians, and we'll get into that later, but almost nightly right now in Russia, there are hundreds of drones sent in by Ukraine, not on military targets, but on residential apartment buildings. That's what the people of the Donbass suffered, and it was time for the Russian Federation to do something for its own country and protecting it from the encroachment of NATO and to protect those Russians who just bureaucratically were a part of Ukraine.
Yeah, so I don't mean to digress too much, but I love history. Obviously, you are doing a masterclass in history as we speak here. Sometimes I struggle because I think of the Soviet Union, and what we learned, or what I learned, was that the Soviet Union was obviously communist. They were anti-religion, grew up learning that Lenin was an atheist and religion wasn't really allowed. And the whole communist thing doesn't work. I think we've seen it happen enough in this world to see that it's not a good system. How do you reconcile the Soviet bloc and communism and its fall? Because it seems like it didn't work in how it's influencing Russia today.
Okay, great question. Thank you. First of all, yes, Lenin was an atheist, but he was not anti-religion. There were many Bolsheviks in the revolution and the government who were anti-religion, and there were churches destroyed. There was persecution of Orthodox Christians. But at the highest levels, no, and as the government formed, he was personally an atheist, but he actually had an appreciation for Christian principles. Many of the top Bolsheviks that I have studied in their writings and their books actually appreciated Christian principles. So I would tell you, and it would be a show in itself, it's fascinating that some of them, of course, it was not outwardly at all accepted, but many of them actually were Orthodox Christians. But that, of course, was not a governmental decision. But a lot of the principles that they based it upon, when I've read the collected works of Stalin, I've read Lenin, to get an understanding of actually what they were basing this government upon. And did they actually base it on it? And did it have good repercussions? And actually, unlike what you had just shared, it had amazing achievements in the society. Now, address that religious aspect in a moment that you asked about. First of all, I would say that the definition that Americans think of as communism is very skewed. And as a historian, it's not the actual definition of communism when we're talking about the Soviet Union. Communism has never been achieved. When you read what Marx wrote about, it's a theory. It's an idea. It's like an ideal that they felt would be good for people. But it was never achieved. They had the Communist Party, but there was never communism, historically speaking. What there was in the Bolsheviks established was a socialist government. They would like that to one day lead to communism where there's no classes and no division and people had adequate provision. That's what they discussed. That's what they wrote about. But the socialist government that Lenin and was carried on by Stalin during those times actually worked quite well. As I said, the literacy was amazing. The literacy rate for people who had never would have had an opportunity to Lenin, it was very important that people's education, they had traveling libraries and brought books and teachers for that the common person who would never have had a chance to be reading, and they would get the classics from all over the the world, including the United States, for people to be able to read. The education system, the opportunities for people just exploded. It was finally people were able to choose and have that education. I would remind you that even prior to World War II, and why the Soviet Union was so prepared was because they also focused upon science, rockets, exceptional development in rocketry. And this was because the people actually at that time, like I said, if you go back and you read some of the memoirs of just people, everyday people, the lives improved. Socialism in Lenin's and Stalin's Soviet Union actually worked, and it worked tremendously well. And at the time, per to our conversation today, other countries around the world were paying attention to it as a model because they were amazed that people could go from barely making it and not. The death rate, the birth rate was so low, the disease, and to see all of this eliminated and these people who previously suffered so much actually living lives. And in many of the ways that we would measure a society, in Stalin's Soviet Union, I was amazed to find that the existence actually excelled in a number of measurable ways that of Americans at the time. So it is one of those dark myths, I would say, that really worked well for the United States government to make Americans feel that it was oppressive. Yes, now in terms of repression and what you were alluding to in terms of religious persecution, in the beginning, during the revolution itself, we're talking about many thousands of individuals participating in that, there were atrocities committed. There were people murdered solely because they were Christian. However, that did not reflect. It's more of the tragedy of any war that is happening, just like the one right now in Ukraine and Russia, what's going on there on the ground in the Ukraine. But it was not systematic. It was not at all what the Bolshevik government wanted. And in fact, under Stalin, if anybody did any type of summary executions of people, because they did have hearings, and a lot of the people that persons will identify with the Orthodox Church and say that they were martyrs were actually working with the Fifth Column, with Western agencies receiving financial support to overthrow the Bolshevik government. These were not people that, after a hearing, were executed, as they were, if they were convicted of actually attempting to overthrow the government or participate in assassinations. They might be an Orthodox priest, for example, or deeply involved in the church, but if they were simultaneously, which the West doesn't like to focus upon, actively working against the government, no government allows that. The vast majority, however, that were sent to the prisons, they were sent to prisons. Many actually were not executed. Numbers that people hear about, millions, tens of millions, hundreds, all of these, it's like pull a number out that they say that are responsible and that Stalin was this brutal murderer are completely false. There are a number of books that there's a professor, let me think of his name, a Grover Furr, F-U-R-R. I would highly recommend your audience that would like to examine that because that's not what we want to get to the SMO here. But if you in any way, what you think about the Soviet life and especially about Stalin, I would say almost everything an American thinks about Stalin is completely a lie. And the CIA, I read the papers when I think these were declassified in 2017. I got another group of them from 2019. But we can go back and see where the CIA and prior to that, the OSS had identified that the number one threat to the United States from Stalin was the fact that his people were so educated. We cannot compete. Again, emphasis on competition in the world. Nothing about a military threat. The Soviet Union was not an overt threat in any way, but they wanted the American people to believe that. And again, other peoples in the world, just like right now, the majority of the world know the truth about the Ukraine-Russia conflict, and it's only Americans and those in Western countries that are left in the dark. But Grover Furr, highly recommend to learn the truth about how Stalin governed and how all of those numbers about people being murdered and mass executions are complete lies fabricated both by Khrushchev and thereby picked up by the CIA to be repeated. The historians, frankly, I am just disgusted with some of the quote historians that say that they are experts on the Soviet Union because all they do is regurgitate these endless lies. And I go straight to the records. I go straight to the records of the NKVD, the KGB, and the CIA. And what we can see there is there were no millions being executed. The vast majority who were convicted of a crime were simply sent to villages where people lived. Yeah, it was a hard life. It was very very cold in Siberia, as it is still today. Beautiful, but a very rough life. And the majority also would go to work camps, and the vast majority of those left. They did not die in those camps, as Americans call them, gulag, an abbreviation because they can't pronounce the Russian words. But it is a complete misnomer about Soviet society as well as the persecution. I would also add, since you talked about the churches, Stalin, in fact, once the power came from Lenin and upon his death, Stalin had quite an Orthodox Christian background. And he actually, we know from both his children and their books and their interviews, as well as others in the government, as well as his personal bodyguard, that especially in those years during World War II, he regularly met with a priest, prayed, went to confession. And once the power went from the Bolshevik government, which was certainly far more atheistic, into Stalin, he later had thousands of churches rebuilt across the country. So it's a whole lot of history there that most Americans don't know, to put it in perspective. But Grover Fuhr, you can learn a lot about the truth about the Soviet Union. He is one of only a very few in the world that have cared to research it.
I am not here to argue with you. And obviously, you're a very well-spoken, well-educated woman. And I really appreciate it. So when I pose my questions, just remember, I'm posing them from what I've learned. I know a lot of what I learned was Stalin didn't, of course, there's stories of the gulags, and he would execute people, especially people he thought were potential problems. But I know his greatest weapon was famine. Like, he would cut off food supplies to certain areas and just carve out millions of people. He didn't need a gun. Okay. He just needed to control the supply lines. And ultimately, I think that even the U.S. at this point is in some form of a socialist government. You can see it all in Western Europe and all over the world. But how do you reconcile the stories of mass famine and the stories of... Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, certainly. No, excellent questions. I appreciate every one of your questions, because it's rare to be able to have the opportunity to share some of the facts with people, because this is what we grew up with. Man, what you are asking me is what I thought for many years of my life, until I really began, as they say, that deep dive in my career into the history. No, actually, the most famous case of what you're saying is called the Holodomor. And it has particularly become very popular to discuss, as if Stalin had purposely starved millions of Ukrainians. And I can tell you, I researched that. First of all, starvation was never used. There's not a single instance of where Stalin withheld food as a technique of power and control over any of the regions of the Soviet Union. The most famous one being the Holodomor. It's very interesting to study how popular that has become with many people. And they bring up the Holodomor and they accept it as a fact, as if he starved Ukrainians. He had nothing against Ukrainians. And what happened during that time frame, and first of all, let me tell you about the word. It actually derived, Ukraine hired, it's very interesting, California writers and those involved in the industry, entertainment industry, to come up
communist
with a
socialist.
Very good story. Pardon?
I said communist socialist, right? It was a joke, sorry.
Okay. They hired an agency in order to fabricate a story of mass starvation intentionally done by Stalin against the Ukrainians. They did this, and this became popular right after the SMO began. And that is when you started to see it. In fact, even commercials and ads were actually taken out and placed in Western publications to, quote, educate. And guests started popping up to talk about the Holodomor. But it never happened. Was there starvation in Ukraine? Yes, but no more than there was in the rest of the regions, including the Russian region, including Europe. This had been, unfortunately, just due to the environmental factors, something all of those in the Soviet regions, as well as all of Europe, have been dealing with for hundreds of years, thousands of years. And every so many years, because of the weather and because of the situation, then there would be crops entirely wiped out. And Stalin was actually known for trying to, what little was there, to disperse that equally, though never adequately, because there was not adequate food at that time. It reminds me of even during World War II, a whole fascinating situation about what happened to the prisoners of war, the German prisoners of war. Very sad stories about how the German prisoners of war were mistreated. They call them Eisenhower camps because he was heading up the military, and the starvation that happened of German prisoners of war during that time. While as in the Soviets, it's not good to be a prisoner of war at all at that time, but they actually, yes, there was mass starvation. situation, in both situations, the Americans actually had ample food supplies and would withhold it in a number of camps. This is documented from U.S. military. They're on record. I've seen them interviewed. I've read what they've written. They have come out and they've even testified here in the United States about the intentional starvation of German prisoners of war. I know I'm digressing, but it's really the same point. The accusation that what the Russians or the Soviets did was the Soviets during that time actually fed them, but no more. And I read the decree from Stalin and it was implemented. It had to be implemented because, yes, you had better follow the order. But the food had to be given to those prisoners of war. It was the same during the mass starvations that would happen across the Soviet region and Europe. Nothing happened to the Ukrainians intentionally. There is absolutely no evidence of that whatsoever. And the Europeans themselves were suffering and starving at those times. So they simply took a very tragic natural disaster, we could call it, and actually retained U.S. writers, entertainment writers, and designers to make this story of the Holodomor. It is entirely fabricated, and I researched that very much because it deeply concerned me.
So getting back to the special military operation or war between Russia and Ukraine. So I have a two-part question.
Okay.
First is, do you think Trump wants to attempt peace? Obviously, he's made a lot of opportunities. He's had negotiations with Putin, trying to reach a peace accord between the two countries. But so do you think that he actually is really trying to achieve that? Do you think Putin is trying to achieve that? And what do you think Putin really wants to achieve before he kind of signs that deal and goes along?
Great question. I would say that I view all of the Trump negotiations as political theater. I believe firmly that Trump is trying to pose as a mediator, which in itself is ludicrous when the United States, as I have briefly touched upon, is the direct cause of the Ukraine-Russia conflict. This would not be happening if not for the United States and what they've done in Ukraine against Russia. And Trump has not renunciated that. Trump could have stopped this immediately. I remember his words. They sounded great that he was going to put an end to this, what he said on day one, and he said on week one. I don't know what he kept changing. I think one time he said he would end
hours.
It even before he took office. Yeah, 24 hours. And at one time he said he would end it before he even took office. And of course, that time frame keeps going on. And he says, oh, it's more complicated than I thought. No, it is not more complicated. If Trump truly wanted peace here, since the United States is the one making all of this possible, there would not be nightly bombings in Russia and attacks in Russia. There would not be attacks on the oil vessels in the Black Sea. There would not be any of this happening. None of this would have even happened if the Minsk agreements had been honored. But they knew that the U.S., they wanted to arm Ukraine for this. Trump, number one, could have easily done it, quote, in 24 hours. It would have ceased within a week or two, really, afterwards. And all he had to do was to stop supplying weapons. But I remind you, although he wants to say it's not his war, he also bragged when he was running for office that he was the first U.S. president during his first term to provide Ukraine with lethal weapons. And he was. This is not, quote, Biden's war. This is every U.S. president's war because this goes back for decades. And when we take a look right at what's happening in Ukraine, Trump was a part of it. Biden was, of course, a part of it. And when Trump came in, he could have stopped all weaponry to Ukraine. He could have stopped all intelligence because they cannot use those missiles and even a lot of the drones and certainly the missiles without the United States intelligence, without Starlink. If he truly wanted peace and an end to this tragic bloodshed for Ukrainians who are suffering and dying as well as Russians, he could have stopped it right then because the Russians had never used aggression. It had only been in self-defense. So Trump says he wants peace and he wants to be a peacemaker. That seems to be what he is saying, but everything internationally, not discussing domestic policy, but internationally, he is not a peacemaker. I digress, but you take a look at Gaza and the genocide that is happening there, and all he is thinking about is the development, even sharing disgusting memes of himself as a gold statue or lying on the beach there. This is what he laughs at when we are talking about tens of thousands of people being murdered and their homes being taken away from them. He's not a peacemaker, but he does care about that image. He wants that image, and he's also a man that never wants to say that he lost. So for him to pose as a mediator and say this would be another one of the wars with his ludicrous count of 8 or 9, which is nonsense, any of us who have studied those conflicts. But nevertheless, on this, he could have stopped all intelligence, weapons directly, weapons to NATO, because the United States is essentially NATO, one and the same, if he had wanted peace. But he's doing this charade so that he can appear as a peacemaker. He's hoping hoping that he can bring a diplomatic later rather than sooner into this, for which he will get the credit. But again, he is the cause. So it is a very strange thing to see this political theater going on, because he's trying to play the part, hope that it does end, and it will end, and Russia's going to be victorious either militarily, and if they have been trying to come to the table numerous times, get past Minsk, get to Istanbul in 2022. They had come to an agreement. Then Boris Johnson from the UK came in there. I know, I would suspect that's not alone. The West works together to make sure it didn't happen. They did not want an end to this. They only wanted escalation. So no, I'd have to say that he calls for peace, but he's insincere. His actions totally contradict his words. And ultimately, Ukraine is just fully controlled by Washington. All right. And Trump is just the figurehead here, but the United States wants to continue to use Ukraine in this manner. No, I don't think Trump really wants peace. He wants a quote peace where he gets credit once this stops. But I just see his ego does not want to have a loss. So he needs somehow to frame it, work with the Russians. The Russians have been very patient with him and doing these meetings. Meanwhile, they continue militarily, because nothing on paper meets what you just asked me about. What does Putin want? In terms of Putin, he has repeatedly tried to solve this, and they came right to it once it had begun, even though they had been betrayed in Minsk 1 and 2. But then they had this agreement. They withdrew their troops. They were not leaving the areas of Kiev and a couple central cities in Ukraine because of the talks in Istanbul. And as a sign of goodwill, Russia withdrew its troops. And then, of course, it completely failed. Ukraine continued to fight. The Russians lost that land that they had easily gotten, since it was completely, relatively unexpected. I think that Putin has always wanted peace. I will have to say that his actions over the last 20 years has proven to me that it's not about aggression. He's been very firm, and even the restraint that has been shown against Ukraine, targeting a military targets, civilian death is extremely low. There are a lot of fake videos, and I would point this out to your audience when you're watching our news in the United States. You can take a look in the corner of where the videos come from. A lot of us have investigated some of these videos coming from Ukraine saying that civilians are being hit, for example, and it comes out to be videos from some other part of the world, for example. Their false flags and fabrications are so extensive. One could talk for several hours on those that have been disproven. Putin just wants an end to the persecution of the Russian speakers in all of those regions. They're now a part of Russia. That is not up for discussion. The Donbass and Kharkiv, Crimea are all part of Russia now. And that is going to have to be recognized. And that can be recognized, and the Ukrainians can unconditionally surrender along with an agreement. But I can tell you what's not going to happen, that United States and Trump continues to talk about, is like a freeze, a ceasefire and a freeze. Whether that's at Christmas time or another time, absolutely not, because all of history, recent history, has shown that in any freeze, the Americans and all of the NATO countries immediately begin rearming Ukraine. I do believe that Putin wants peace. I think Trump won't quote peace so he can get quote peace on his side, just so that it appears that way, the surface and the appearance that he was part of it. And it will happen probably later, since the U.S. is still playing games with what they put on paper. But when it happens, Trump really is focused on business. And everybody wants business and normalization with Russia. In fact, Lavrov, foreign ministry of Russia, just the other day, met once again with the president of the United States Chamber of Commerce. And business in the United States, companies want that restored. Russia has capitalism. The United States really wants that. This political hostilities and military hostilities from the United States is only hurting the United States, hurting Europe. Europe is going bankrupt. Ukraine has always been baked, by the way. They relied upon the International Monetary Fund, United States. They've really had no independence whatsoever. So yeah, I do believe Putin wants peace. He wants an end to this as soon as possible. He's shown great restraint militarily. The United States simply wants to appear as if they're neutral mediators, even though they could stop it at any moment, and they do.
Does peace start? He's obviously conquered some of those territories, right? Does he stop there, or does he push towards Kyiv, or how does that peace come about? If parties aren't ultimately working together to, hey, you're going to take this, I'm going to take that, we're going to sign a peace accord, how do you see this ending.
Okay. I do believe that everything stated, and I would say this, I want to get to your question. The audience that we have out there, go, it's available to you. This is a wonderful time to live. We've got the internet. Go and listen or read Putin's speech when the SMO happened. Read it, because when that happened, I went line by line and examined everything that he said historically, and all of it was true. And it would really be good if people would actually read that. It was very long, but it was telling the Russian people why this was happening. But it's telling the world. Anyone out there can go to the February 22nd, 22 speech by Putin as to why the SMO was begun. It was true then, it's true now, and everything said in it, they are going to be victorious. As for the scenario, as how that happens, in terms of the territories, Russia has stated, and we have every reason to believe them because they have never been trying to acquire territory to rebuild an empire. On the contrary, we do have a lot of regions in Ukraine, or several regions in Ukraine, who have been asking. They want it to return to their motherland. Only those territories, the four territories that have become a part of Russia by the Constitution and vote it, will is what Russia wants. Russia has extended that now to needing to make a buffer zone. That is because of the nightly shelling of civilians from Ukrainian territory. They said there will need to be a buffer zone so that they cannot continue to kill Russian civilians. They, of course, are not going to allow Ukraine to become part of NATO, and there needs to be an actual president to sign anything. Zelensky, this evil clown, among all the European clowns that we see, really the nonsense of the European Union is becoming ludicrous to us that are involved in geopolitics to see the things that they are saying, all their vitriolic hatred for Russia. Put aside all the talk you hear from people like Mertz, it's just absolutely crazy, or the British, and you get down to the Russians simply want those territories and a buffer zone. They do want the demilitarization. They need that guaranteed. We talk about security guarantees for Ukraine. The truth of the matter is that Russia is the one who needs security guarantees. I do not see them wanting any other territories, but as long as the Ukrainians, which is the United States, continues to fight militarily, then the Russians are going to have to continue. And right now, I will say that if they do not come to the table and agree to a peace, which can happen at any time, Russia is ready for that. It's just their security guarantees are really not considered. The last Trump plan included a few, but it also included some absurdities in there in terms of Russian monies and all of that being discussed. But I believe that it would probably have to be solved militarily, but at any time the Russians are ready to solve it as long as their security is guaranteed. But if they don't come to it diplomatically, Russia, I think, may need to, especially with the attacks on the shipping in the Black Sea. There is many Russians and those who are with Russia in the city of Odessa. Odessa is a Russian city. It is a port built by Russia. Again, bureaucratically became part of Ukraine in the Soviet Union. There is a mass underground of those that we are aware of. It's very dangerous for them there in Odessa, just waiting for Russian troops to liberate them. And when I say liberate, as they come into these areas of Ukraine we've been discussing, they are very glad that the Russians have come. I believe that there's a possibility that Russia will need to, because of the continued hostilities militarily, get to Odessa. I'll say this personally. Russians know more than I do. Don't know anything about that. But as somebody who cares about the security of Russia, and I want to see peace for the Ukrainians and the Russians, it seems to me that coming to Odessa, liberating it, going straight up the Dnieper River, it's a natural divide in Ukraine between east and west, and that could serve as the end point to finally bring peace to the area. And if I may, I want to, when I discuss the idea of liberation, I want to tell you what is found when they liberate areas or some of the areas that Ukrainians took over in Russian areas before. I watched a lot of the videos even as it was happening, not knowing even that we have a few journalists actually on the ground in Ukraine and in Russia in the areas, going down into the basements and finding civilians bound. This is what the Ukrainians do. And again, I differentiate between being evil done by a few and systematic evil. This is systematic with the Ukrainian forces. We alluded to it earlier about the far right sectors, the Azov battalion. They routinely murder civilians, anyone who they can see had gotten any rations or food rations from Russians, anyone that they feel is not with them, civilians, elderly people. We found many of them in their basements, shot in the head after being tortured. This is routine, I have to say, sadly. The Ukrainians have suffered greatly, even in Ukraine, from the mobilization. So many have tried to escape if they can't escape without being executed. They want to be liberated. So I would have to say there are many that want to be liberated. It may happen militarily, and that is going to be a blessing for tens of thousands of Ukrainians who desperately want to be back with their motherland.
So I've said this before, and I think I'll say it until Jesus comes back. I think all wars are banker wars, corporate wars. Mm-hmm. How much of this conflict do you think has to do with BRICS? Because I know China, Russia, India, they're all getting together trying to create their own gold-based currency that replaces the U.S. dollar. Do you think this is like the first front of maybe potentially a third world war?
I think all of this could be, and that is why I'm very sad to see in other areas how Trump seems to be very reckless internationally on international policy. He has spoken, showing his ignorance sometime when he tries to talk about BRICS. He doesn't even know the countries as you do anyone very easy. And of course, a number of countries have been added. I think that he is a fearful man. I think representing the United States interest and American hegemony, which is what the United States is about, maintaining their hegemony. I think that BRICS is based purely on cooperation, trade between nations, just the opposite of how Trump is conducting himself as the world's bully economically and militarily, as if might makes right when it is not true. BRICS has been outstanding, incredible. When you talk about the gold standard, interestingly enough, I think it may have just been in the last month or maybe within the last couple months that the largest gold reserves for a government is actually held by the Russian Federation. The countries of BRICS are, the fundamental of BRICS is respecting the sovereignty of the nations that you are trading with, not using manipulation, not using threat of force, not using threat to steal whatever you have and your natural resources. And it works. That is the way for humanity to relate to each other. I do think in terms of the devaluing of the dollar, we also take a look at what is happening in Europe. It is economically collapsing. The United States, of course, remains that mighty power militarily and economically. But even that, we're seeing the cracks in it now. Certainly for the common man suffering in the United States, regardless of what Trump wants to say, millions of Americans know for a fact they are not doing as well. They may like some of his policies, but in terms of economically, they are suffering. I do think that Trump fears, not only when we talk about geopolitically ever having a quote loss, even if it's not a win for him, he wants to paint it as such. And I think, for example, like the Russians, they understand what they're dealing with in him. And if he needs that for his ego, they don't care. They simply want this war to end and to have that peace. Economically, yeah, I think that Trump really fears BRICS. And what if he were a righteous man, which he is very much shown, particularly in his second term, he is not. If he were a righteous man and evaluated everything from right and wrong, what BRICS is doing is the future, the multipolar world, not the world where the U.S. has hegemony. All we're talking about here is economics, and it works when you respect other countries' sovereignty and simply trade with them, not bully them and not steal from them and not threaten them in order to have their resources and the benefit of their resources. But again, the United States, sadly, going back to our early history, is an empire, colonial empire, just as Britain was. But yeah, I think that's a great point. I think he fears BRICS. I think he knows very little. Sadly, he knows more domestically than he does anything internationally, and the people around him are, it's a joke to look at the people that surround him as if they can tell him anything that is in the best interests of the United States. In terms of World War III, yeah, I think that we may have never been closer, and that even includes what, you know, happened in Cuba years ago. I think we're closer now to that potential. I think that is because of the recklessness of those in Europe who want that war. When you take a look at the leaders of Europe, the people are against them. The people are suffering. I think that's going to be coming to the United States, and people will be suffering in their daily lives. But it's already happening in Europe, and they don't like it. And what for? To fight a war against Russia? Exactly what you're saying. For the bankers, for those who are invested in all of the military establishment and Northwest, you know, and BlackRock. Look at BlackRock, Merck. All of them have their existence based based upon war. The Western countries and NATO is entirely based upon having an enemy, always an enemy, that we have to fight. And the common man is paying for it and could die for it. And it's not worth it. There's no reason. BRICS shows us there can be international cooperation, and that's the way it should be. You don't need hegemony.
So I have one stupid question, potentially, and one that's probably a little bit smarter. So I'll ask the stupid one first.
Why is stupid Putin, first?
Yeah, stupid first. You remember me for the smart stuff. Why does Putin always refer to the war as this special military operation? I never quite understood why he always called it that versus a war in and of itself. And then my second question, which I promise is a little bit smarter, but I just never understood the first one, is a lot of what we hear in America and the United States and through the European Union is that Ukraine is the first stop. People like Poland and other countries that share borders like Moldova and other places have from Russia. Is that a reality on the ground, or is that just rumor we're hearing in this country and beyond?
Okay, great questions. Yes, special military operation for the Russian Federation is a very restrained effort. Although it does use military forces, it is all out different than at any time when a war. During a war, and if this ever escalates due to the West or the European countries, which we already have, by the way, proven, not just mercenaries from the United States and Britain and many other countries who are being paid to be there now because the Ukrainian has run out of most of the Ukrainians. Very sad what they've done to their own people for this. But if it were indeed a war, if hopefully it does not escalate to that, Russia would not hold back. There is no way that in 4 years, if Russia had any aggression, even moving on to your second question a little bit as I answer, but staying on the first one, had it been a war, it would have been with the weaponry that Russia has, which I would have to say in certain areas is far superior to the United States, but both are the most powerful, but it has the largest supply of nuclear weapons. It has the NIC. It has incredible hypersonic missiles. It could have, as the United States has waged war, as NATO has done. I think back of all the NATO, you could easily just start to name off like 30 or 40 NATO where they completely wipe out peoples. I think of Yugoslavia and Serbia, not for any threat, but for, again, hegemonic control. If they had wanted that, this would have been over very quickly. Within weeks, it would have been over if Russia actually cared nothing about the Ukrainian people and simply wanted land. To your second question, even, if that is what they wanted, they could have advanced. They could have taken this land. This would have been over very quickly if it was Ukrainian land, much less any other place in Moldova, the Balkanized state, the other state and regions around there. No, the special military operation is a restraint using a very small fraction of Russian military in order to accomplish exactly the goals that Putin stated. The freeing of these people from oppression and to remove the direct threat that NATO was posing to Russia. Again, if it had been a war, they would have eliminated Ukraine. You think about the U.S. and its long history of carpet bombing and destroying a people for whatever reason that they state to the United States, but it wasn't. No, I would have to say the words that you're hearing from Poland are just spiritually insane, geopolitically, politically, extremely dangerous, certainly escalation. But these are all people who are extremely unpopular in their countries. And the only way that they can survive, you take a look at Zelensky and all of the money that he has. It's not just him. There are numerous, easily numbered from my study, probably 20 to 30 that have become multimillionaires in the Kiev regime around Zelensky. Where did that money come from? Look at yourselves. It's our tax money. And that has been going to them. So the same with the European leaders that you hear talking. In fact, just recently, how disgusting to be telling, I read one of the generals in England just now saying that everybody's children are going to have to die to fight Russia. And when you hear these small little countries, often with these stupid women, and of course, that's the way it's won it. That's what NATO won't. They're easily controlled. Speaking as if there is any threat, there is no historical basis for it whatsoever. There is no basis on this. If Russia's goal had been to create or recreate, as they say, an empire like the Soviet Union, they could have done it. They have withheld so much of their might. So a special military operation is a very small restraint using a fraction of the military to accomplish a stated purpose. A war is destruction of the enemy, but they're ready to do it if the West foolishly escalates. And of course, all of us do not want that.
So how do you think it ends? Because I'm just going to restate what you said. It seems like Western Europe is preparing for another world war. Like you said, that yes. they're telling their populations that their children may have to die to fight Russia. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me because all those countries are, they all have nuclear weapons. What is the logical conclusion of this? Because it seems like the West wants to push it to that point. And I have my own reasons to think that ultimately that may happen. But what is Russia's next move at this point?
I would say that the next move will be to finish this. It looks like it will have to be done militarily. I personally believe that they will stop after they have that buffer zone and Ukraine can no longer murder Russia. And I believe that you will see Russia stop and cease entirely. Now, if the Europeans foolishly want to escalate, I will tell you this. They can do nothing and they will do nothing. They can run their mouths, but unless they had the support of the United States, whether it's Trump or any other U.S. president, to proceed to threaten Russia, because Russia is not going to aggress against them. But if they ever make the effort, and of course, really, technically, the United States, we call it a proxy war, but the U.S. is at war with Russia, but they keep it at, quote, proxy. But we already now have English paratroopers, their bodies dying, not as mercenaries, but they were there as British military inside of Ukraine. That is a declaration of war against Russia. And I'm sure Russia is keeping that into consideration. How it will end is I believe that Russia will most likely have to do this militarily, achieve all of the stipulations that we've already discussed, the protection of all the people in those regions, and enough of a buffer zone that they cannot continue to fire into Russia and kill Russians. That demilitarization and a new government in Ukraine, leave that to the U.S. and Poland, and they can have their little rump portion, such as it is, if they want that land. I am sure that Russia will be quite accommodating, as they have historically, in order to help those people. And even if they do liberate Odessa, allow them to use the port, even supervised, of course, so weapons don't come in as they are doing now in order to export their wheat. To me, Russia is really the wise and righteous one in this battle against the United States and against Europe. World War III, what is ultimately going to happen in the world? And I think you said you had some personal beliefs about that. So if you would ask me to speak personally, I'll tell you my hope, of course, is I believe this will be ended satisfactorily. And I believe that Ukraine and the Ukrainians, hopefully, despite a couple of generations of their men and women, for that matter, gone, will have whatever country. It will be demilitarized. It will no longer pose a threat to Russia. I don't believe Russia has any aggressive aims on any other country unless they are attacked. They never attacked, just like in this was a very patient self-defense, finally, after 8 years. But ultimately, I will go to the fact that I'm a Christian, and I believe that all of this is a part of the spiritual war between good and evil in this world. And I'm here to tell you from all of my study, Russia, in this case, is the good. And it is a Christian nation, far more than the United States, far more than almost any country in the world. And I mean that quite seriously, not peripherally or superficially. And as such, I personally believe that this is part of it. I look at Russia's history with fascination, that there has always been attacks on it, and those claims that Russia has attacked others. No, you go back in history and see who attacked who. Finland, you want to be talking the other day. Who attacked who? They also include in their ludicrous talk as if Russia attacked countries when we're talking about World War II. Liberation, even liberation in Poland. You want to talk about how many people would have died, been murdered by the German Nazis had Russia not, Soviet Union, not gone into that part per their agreement. What I'm saying, to sum it up, I do believe that there's a spiritual basis to all of this. And I feel sadly, unlike United States wanting to claim that it's a Christian nation and all of that, the government and the way that it treats people worldwide is not Christian at all. And there are millions of people dead all over the world because of the United States, NATO, CIA operations. In prophecy, if you talk personally and you had your personal beliefs, there will be that World War III. I have a belief that prophecy might be here to warn us, to prevent it, not that it's destined to be, not set in stone. But I will say that if it ever came to that, the United States would certainly be eliminated within just a few minutes, considering the Russian Federation submarines that are just off our coast. If they are ever attacked, and if it were coming from a European nation, as you talked about, the weapons that they have, I would say England would be gone in a matter of moments. So I think they know that, and I think that their running of their mouths right now is simply their egos talking and their fear that their people are going to turn against them, which they are. I hope that, as a human being, never happens. happens for us on this earth, but if it does, or to any degree thereof, I want there to always be Russia. Russia is far more important to me than any other country on earth, because I think throughout history, I'm seeing the workings spiritually like the last bastion of Christianity. It's a good society. It's based on good principles. And most importantly to me, as someone who's been really anti-NATO my whole life, I don't believe in aggression. I do believe in cooperation. I believe in having a tremendous self-defense, but I also believe in everyone putting that aside. And the United States could do that right now. Stop all of this war and start doing business. And that's what the United States likes to do. And they could start doing some great business with Russia again. European Union will have its choice. They're not going to act independently, as you suggested, against Russia because they know they would be eliminated. They're never going to do anything. They are simply vassals of the United States. If the United States does not authorize it, it's not going
to
happen.
I think, to be clear, if there is a war between Russia, United States, European Union, what have you, I think nobody wins that war, right?
No,
because
of course
not. Too many nuclear weapons in play. And even if you push the button the fastest, it's not a world you're ultimately going to want to inherit.
Well, of course not. Nobody wants it.
End of time prophecies, right?
Yeah, you got to be insane. Yeah, exactly. That's what his question suggested to me. Otherwise, I wouldn't bring it up, but it really suggests that. But I will say this, interestingly enough, just from the human perspective, living in the United States, as we see this, our society is getting worse. The food security, the prices, certainly, our everyday life, all right, the violence that is in our society, all of this is at a time when, I can tell you, in Russian society, it is much better. It's certainly far better than any most of the European countries. There are some other good places in the world. But I would say there's no comparison between the quality of life for an average Russian and an average American. And the funny thing about it is Americans think they have it the best, the land of the free and liberty, and yet they're struggling day to day. Most people are struggling, and it is only getting worse. And yet in Russia, it's not that way. To your doomsday in scenario, whatever degree that would happen, of course, that is hell on earth. That is truly the hell coming from human beings' egos if that were to happen. But for the Russian people, at least, it cannot accommodate everyone in that vast country. About half the population of the U.S., although much bigger, the biggest country on earth, they actually have underground facilities stocked with water and food for many months for much of their population. If you live in a Russian city, not just Moscow, but many of the Russian cities, in such a scenario, if whatever degree there is an exchange and weapons are landing in Russia, many people have a place to go. In the United States, only the quote special people of Washington, D.C. and all over this country will immediately go to their special place. They don't care about you and I. Human life means nothing to the U.S. government, and the U.S. government is made up of Americans who got the power. Greed, power seems to be the motivator of almost every American, and the ones at the top are exploiting the rest of us. And it's just sad that so many of my fellow Americans don't see they're being used. They get caught up in their left versus right, their Democrat versus Republican, but all the while, both of them at the top, and as you alluded to before, the bankers, the entire military complex and all those making money, they will survive and they have made accommodations if worse comes to worse. But they don't care about the American people. Just that evil, I would say demonic, Lindsey Graham speaking, and others have repeated it, that they're going to keep fighting this conflict until the last Ukrainian. What human being says that about a people? We don't want Ukrainians gone. I tell you, Russians more than anyone don't want these brotherly fellow Orthodox Christian people to be gone. And their deaths are straight on the U.S. government. And hopefully it never comes to that. But I would say even in the worst situation, at least the Russians care about their people and trying to save some. And they also have the dead hand. You may have heard about that. They have a lot more since the dead hand. But even in the worst case scenario of the Russian government being unable to control the weapons would immediately be sent. Hopefully, if any nuclear is kept within, and any of it is tragic, but kept within a certain boundary so that there is not full devastation on this earth. But even if it is contained, I would say that the United States, relatively speaking, is going to get the worst of it. England, Europe would be gone. Russia's a very large nation. We all hope we do the good we can do. And I would say for every American listening to me, get out of your idea that the United States is the good guys because they have been savage. And it pains me to have to say this about my country, but they have been savage and brutal. And NATO is simply a tool, a military tool of the United States. It has never been defended. offensive. And as soon as the Soviet Union was no more, they immediately began using their military might against other countries, and many civilians have suffered. It should have been dismantled if it was truly defensive against communism, but that wasn't its purpose, and it is not its purpose now.
First of all, when I think of the Russia and Ukraine war, to me, it's very sad because I almost view it as like the civil war that we saw in the United States many years ago, because a lot of the Russians and Ukrainians are essentially kin. They're brothers and sisters, they're family members, they're relatives, right?
Yes.
So they're a very close people if you look at it from an historical lens. So I do view that as very sad. But I also sometimes wonder, does the ends justify the means? That's how I look at it to see if we've solved the problem. Is there going to come to a point where Putin is, there's too much bloodshed, I need to step back from this red line because the war's going on and the people I'm trying to save, the body count's rising, and we've killed more people than we could have potentially saved. Sometimes I wonder if the United States and others are like, just make the war last long enough so that he gives up and there has to be no further incursion.
Sure.
Is there something there?
No, but that is what the American government wants Americans to believe. Number one, going to that phrase, the end justify the means, whoever you apply that to, certainly that is not the way the Russian Federation operates, but it is how the United States operates. They believe that the end goal, one day that they hope, regime change in the Russian Federation, that is certainly something they would like. They would like to see the people unhappy that there's been so much death, like you're talking about, that they would turn against the government, the Putin government. But that's not happening. I can tell you on the ground in Russia, there is incredible support because, as you and I were just discussing, the Ukrainians are brotherly people. They are fellow Orthodox Christians, and a lot of our audience might not know what that term is. That is the original Christian church. It's an apostolic church directly as Christ and the apostles formed. All the other churches we know of in the world, in the United States, Catholic and Protestants, came from that. So it's the original Christian church. So they share that. But in terms of, they don't operate by the end justifies the means. The U.S. does. And they think that the end of the ultimate either regime change, as if Russians would turn against Putin, they are not. He has incredible support in that country, both because of saving the country from the despair of the 90s and the early 2000s to right now defending the Russian sovereignty, because everybody does understand, and it's a fact, Russian sovereignty was being threatened by Ukraine. In terms of the idea of just making this extend and that Putin might say, as you suggested, that enough is enough and enough death and just come to it. No, not without the stated reasons, because one thing the Russians have learned is that never again are they going to be lied to and duped as they were in Minsk I, Minsk II, and all throughout history, even when they made agreements after the end of World War II, and all of those agreements were betrayed by the U.S. and NATO expansion. They know it's an existential threat and NATO's plans. No, I don't believe that there's going to be any concession in that way from the Russian Federation. And I would say this, the Americans, a lot of Americans I speak to, actually think that the Ukrainians had a chance. I can tell you, militarily, and I do study the military quite a bit. It's not as much as I study the history as a historian, but I'm very fascinated by the military aspect of this. Militarily, from day one, there was no chance that the Ukrainians are ever going to, quote, prevail. That has been ludicrous. It is a special military effort, very much restraint shown, and it is increasing now in terms of the attacks on what they're willing to do in terms of the military targets, including a lot of the NATO and mercenaries that are in Ukraine. And it's interesting in the United States, what happens to those people when they die and what they're told, because they're not supposed to be in Ukraine. But no, I see none of that. Those are stories that are given to you by either Europeans or certainly some of the U.S. politicians who want to act like that there's any, quote, chance. And I go back to right and wrong. Who is right and who is wrong? It would be wrong for Ukraine to, quote, win. There's no chance of that. There never has been. But it would be wrong because all it is NATO aggression. Their goal is to change the government in Russia, take over Russia, ideally, steal all of its resources and have the tremendous benefit of everything that the largest country on earth has. But no, there's no chance of the Russian people turning against their government. And there's absolutely zero chance of that militarily and the loss of life that they're going to stop. The Russians who have died, sadly, having to kill Ukrainians, and most Ukrainians fighting do not want to be there. I can tell you that. The mobilization techniques, they even kill them trying to mobilize them. This is what Ukraine does. It is measured in hours, sometimes days, if not hours, anyone who is sent to the front on the Ukrainian side now. There is no reason for Ukrainians to continue to be dying. Now they're so desperate, they're placing ads all around the world to pay people several thousand dollars to come and fight there. Stupid young men, or older in some cases, think they can go and get a kick out of killing some Russians and make some money. They end up dead very quickly. No, there's no chance of those scenarios. Russia's going to be victorious sooner or later, depending upon what the United States wants.
Yeah, so I know you're a woman of faith. And so this podcast, look at everything through like a biblical lens. And I often think about the war of Ezekiel, and I think of the one world government. And I almost think, and you stated you don't think prophecy is not necessarily, maybe I'm misquoting you, like inevitability. I do think it's an inevitability, but I think God is gracious and he's kind. He will delay, just like he did with Jonah and Nineveh and the Israelites as they repented, he would delay judgment. And I worry that this is setting the stage for that one, like that huge war that ultimately brings forth the one world order, the new world order. And I think in like Revelation, that prophecy, I think one of the armies that ends up going to Jerusalem that God ultimately wipes out is people from Russia. What are your thoughts on that? If biblical prophecy, and how do you see
it? Sure. I've studied that personally. And because my faith is very important to me, your belief that it is inevitable, I have to say, I agree with you. I hope that it is not that complete end. But right now, I'd have to say the path that we're on, some people believe it is inevitable. Some people believe we're being given the chance to change that. But yet, yes, I tend to believe that one day it will come to that. In terms of that one world government, that globalism and everything is exactly what when I read, and I have just gone back over that in terms of both prophecy and Orthodox Christianity. Prophecy is very interesting. I would recommend that scholars and priests writing about that. And they all have believed that it is inevitable as well. But when you read it through the lens of right and wrong, and when I as a historian look at who has always been right, despite what we are told, I see the U.S. now, they're going to lose in Ukraine, try to make it out as we brought peace. They're pivoting now toward China. China's not posing a threat to us, except you could call it, quote, a threat economically, but they're not trying to do something actively against, again, BRICS that you talked about earlier. We also see America pivoting under Trump against Iran, all right? North Korea, China, Russia, Iran. Now that brings back into all that biblical prophecy, Gog and Magog. And although this isn't completely at odds with many Western American evangelists or considered biblical scholars, I think we're all human beings and can use our mind and our faith and our prayer as we read the Bible. And I believe that those two, in terms of that one world government and the evil of the Zionist state, I certainly am against all of these Christians. I believe they are misled, is what I'm saying, in the United States, to think that the United States should side with the Zionist state after all of the evil that it has been doing since 1948, and to align with it and to call that the God's chosen people is an abomination in itself, to refer to the Zionist as God's chosen people. And so I believe that the Antichrist, since you asked me, the Antichrist will likely rise, and we are going to see, and it will be an alignment, I believe, with the United States and the Zionist state and a few actually of the Middle Eastern states. And I believe that one world government may very well ultimately be established. And I feel that the one that is going to do the work of God in that great battle is going to be the very ones that the United States calls their enemies, Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. And I believe that the good are them, and the evil, sadly, is my own country, the United States, and the Zionist state, and those that join with them. So if indeed that, I believe that the United States are going to get the spiritual consequences. I think we already are in our society. And I think ultimately if that happens, they will, because as we know, then in prophecy, despite all of the death and bloodshed, ultimately, though, who is with God? And I will tell you, fundamentally, my belief, not only as a historian in what's going on, but as a Christian, is that God is with the Russians and those that are cooperating and are not aggressing against other nations, but merely dealing in self-defense. It's a very different take than most of my fellow Christians in my country believe, but I believe dispensationalism to be one of the great evils that's happening in my country. And I think that any Christian that aligns themselves with what is Zionist state, they call themselves what, Christian Zionist or something like that, where it's the same as calling yourself a Christian Satanist, because there is no more satanic, demonic country on earth than the Israel of today. God's chosen people in the Bible refers to his people who believe. The new covenant was brought by Jesus Christ. It was taken away, as in the Bible says, from those who only spoke the words and the hypocrites. And to align with a Zionist state, and you can see by their fruits you shall know them, the Zionist state is a murderous state. It always has been. And to align with them and to make that possible, I believe the spiritual consequences are going to come to the United States. I digressed a little bit there, but you brought all that to my mind.
So my second to last question for you, Christine, is how do you view Vladimir Putin just as a man? Because we hear a lot of evil things in the West about what he's done, the horrible assassinations on his opponents, the, what was it? He was putting yeah. like nuclear material and drinks and people were drinking him and stuff.
But oh.
how do you view him, and how do you think the rest of the world outside of like the EU and the United States?
Mm-hmm. Good question. First of all, it could be a show in itself. First of all, the war crimes, atrocities, and everything that they apply to both the Russians during this, I can tell you I've studied them all. I know we're going to wrap up here, but whether you're talking about Bucha, you take a look at the Crocus City Hall, the mass murders that came from Ukraine, the telephones proved it, the cryptocurrency that was paid from Ukraine to those who came into a huge music hall and murdered, I think, about 149 children. It was a children's concert going on, a youth concert, and their families. Bucha was completely staged. I'm just going to quickly touch upon this. This is some of the dark lies that we have been told. I watched as the mayor of Bucha came through after the Russian troops withdrew, for example, and there was no bodies in the street. Give it a day or two after we've all seen that it wasn't, and then they suddenly start appearing. But what I'm saying is, even you're talking about Putin and the stories about them, they are laughable. I actually studied 10 of them many years ago, frankly. I was very interested in each and every one of those cases. I'm not going to go into them now with you guys, but aside from one or two that I just didn't have enough information fully to go into, and even to that degree, I feel all of them to be false narratives from the West. A lot of these people had a lot of enemies. And I would even say that there was one death that happened in Germany where a person was assassinated by a Russian there. That man was reported in the West as if he was just some person living in Germany and had come from Russia, but he had committed a mass atrocity in Russia, which we were all aware of, I believe, laying down, I think it may have been Russian soldiers all in line, and then running, getting his vehicle and running back and forth over them. So he ends up shot in Germany, but they don't tell you what that man had done that had offended, to say the least, many Russians to Putin. So I'm just saying, a lot of the stories would make for a whole show in itself. I'd love to address anything you guys would bring up to me. But in terms of Putin, I would say overall, I've really watched the man for decades now. And I would say that he is, I'd call him, and I am very particular about who I would say this about. I'm an American and I've seen how religion is used to get support from the people when they're so far from being a Christian in this country. But I would say I believe him to be a sincere Christian, even completely out of the public eye, even on his vacations, even when he goes to the far, if it's Pascha, which is the Russian Easter. He will even go to a tiny village church to be able to have communion. He doesn't have to do that. There's a lot of stories. It really seems that he takes to heart his Christianity. I don't think it's for show. I think it's deeply personal. And there's a lot of people, even in some of the most remotest villages, that can tell you about their experiences with him. And there's no cameras there, but there are people that you can speak with. His actions reflect, I'd say, a morality that is most certainly Christian. As the leader of Russia, he's been a great leader. He rebuilt the Russian economy. This is why the people of Russia love him. During the time of after Gorbachev, and it was horrible, and all of the Americans coming in and just really very destructive, I would say, in terms of the society there, and a collapse economically, and then going into Yeltsin and all of that. Putin came in very strong and got rid of a lot of the oligarchs that were profiting from all of that. They didn't expect that. The United States didn't expect that either. He rebuilt the Russian economy and, of course, their army and their industry, because they were in ruins. People suffered. You talk to women and families, and they had the children, and what it was like at that time of the Soviet collapse. And by the time when Putin finally came, he just restored. He restored them economically and their lives and their dignity and their sovereignty as a nation. And he began immediately reducing poverty and improving the living standards, just modernizing the infrastructure. And I tell you, for anyone that, you know, hasn't been to Russia, it is absolutely a magnificent place. If you visit Moscow, it's nothing like the United States. The the metro, which was begun by Stalin, actually, and you see the beauty of it. He actually wanted Moscow to be the most beautiful city for the people, he said. He doesn't want it to be in a museum. He wants all the people. Russia has continued that. Putin continues that. Absolutely beautiful metro stations and art everywhere. There's so much available to the people. Exercise, I'll just tell you, I care about physical fitness a lot. But in the United States, you either have your own exercise equipment and room in your home, as I do, or else you got to pay and go somewhere. In Russia, wherever you live, even the smaller villages, that's all provided to you. There's so much great equipment. It's like it's a national good and priority, the health and the happiness of the people. So I'd say the people are very much behind him. He rebuilt the country. He saved the country, in fact. And as a global figure, you asked, I would say he is respected and appreciated in the majority of the world. And that's difficult for Americans to grasp because we're talking about Africa, the global South. They are being given hope through BRICS and through interactions, not from exploitation, manipulation, you do this or else. You think about how the U.S. gained so much control in the Balkans and everything is coming with their money. You do this, but if you cooperate with, at the time, Soviet Union or now Russia, we won't give you this money. But that's not how Russia, and particularly Russia, is operating. They're bringing education and food to people who have been suffering from colonialism. So I'd say when you include the global South, it's seen as a balance to the U.S. hegemony and domination and exploitation of people. So he's viewed, Putin is viewed as stabilizing. And amidst all the chaos, it's like bringing hope to other people that the world is changing. And the world is changing. It's going to be a multipolar world. And the sooner the United States recognizes it, and it can start doing better economically, certainly Europe, like those fools, they are letting their people suffer for no reason. Russia poses no threat. And I say this objectively. Russia poses no threat to the rest of the world, but they seriously can destroy anyone who attacks them. But I think they only want peace. And to me, in my study of history and recent history, that's all that they want. And BRICS is proof of that.
Yeah, thank you for that. As we close tonight, what do you want to leave the audience with, right? What impression, what lasting impression do you want to leave with us?
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank you, David and Jay, for having me. I thank our audience for listening. I would ask that they have no knee-jerk reactions to anything that I have spoken, because anything that I have shared with you is completely supported and buttressed by the facts when you study them. But it's a very uncomfortable feeling when you start to realize that your country is operating actually as a terrorist state on the rest of the world. And that's what it's doing in Ukraine, Russia, but it's what it's doing. You take a look at Venezuela, again, another topic, and Americans immediately think they know what's going on there, but they don't know. And I'm telling you that there are decades of the covert operations and what is going on all for American hegemony. Just put aside those reactions as an American. You love your family. You love your country. But it's not my country right or wrong. It should be I'm with my country when it is right and not when it is wrong. And that is the only way we're going to change things. It's not a matter of left versus, it's a matter of right versus wrong. And to do that takes study. It takes research. And I'm telling you everything that I've said to you, which is based on many years of study, but it is all supported by the facts, the archives, and just looking at the history of it. Don't listen to your leaders and your media, who is controlled really by the government. That goes back a few decades now, and what they're telling you is what they want you to think. But unfortunately, the United States is the aggressor worldwide. And I think most Americans, really, they just want peace. They want adequate education, food, a good life for themselves, a good job. They just want, that is not those in power want for you. And so don't defend them any longer and seek out some sources. Go read some of the resources that I spoke of earlier. It is out there if you look. Do not believe you're getting the truth when a U.S. politician, no matter who it is, small level or large level, is speaking to you. And do not believe the media spin, because when I watch U.S. news, I watch news from quite a few countries. I like to see how they're all reporting things. It is so biased in terms of what the U.S. government wants you to think. So just be willing to question. As a Christian, truth is my highest priority. As a historian, truth is my highest priority. Make truth your highest priority. And if you don't know, don't choose a side. Don't wave a blue and yellow flag on your little social media account when you don't know what the hell you're talking about. Just just abstain and maybe seek out the truth. Because to align yourself with that which is evil, I think spiritually that does reflect upon you and your soul and your relationship to God. And so if you don't know, withhold judgment, don't choose sides. But I'm telling you, you can know. And there's plenty of opportunity for you to learn these days. So if you're ignorant, you're willfully ignorant. Change that.
Yeah, that's a great response. Thank you for that. And as you mentioned social media, it reminded me of two questions that I got from my audience today.
Oh,
so
okay.
The first question is, do you love the United States? And the second question was, why, if you don't, or if you're like opposed to the United States, why do you remain here? Why don't you like move to Russia? And I don't mean that in any disrespect. I'm just reading what's in front of me today.
All right. No disrespect taken by the question. They're great questions. Do I love the United States? I would tell you that I love all people and none more than others in terms of love for them as my human brothers and sisters. I don't want to see Americans suffer, but I think that they're going to suffer a lot more. I actually think that those are the spiritual consequences for the evil that they have supported worldwide. They have never seemed to care about human life if it meant there was a benefit to the United States. I don't love the United States as a governmental entity. No, the United States to me represents the biggest terrorist nation in the world. And it took me a lot of years to come to that understanding and to have to understand that there's no reconciliation with my beliefs as a Christian and what my government is doing in my name and with my money. I don't love the United States government. I do not love the United States above other countries as if I want this country to prevail if it means the exploitation of anyone else. Absolutely not. But I love the United States when I talk about the people that are here. I do want the best for them. I want them to have the knowledge of God. I want them to have their families. And I see that the greatest threat to that is their actual government that they ironically, sadly, actually support and don't ever. And there are those who do, but it has to change. And I fundamentally don't believe that there is a political solution to a spiritual problem. And the United States has a massive spiritual problem. It is doing the work of Satan in the world. And most Americans actually align with it. And I'm asking you not to, even just for your own sake, to know the truth, as the Bible says, will set you free. And that will set you free from perhaps the repercussions that are going to come to the United States and the suffering. So no, I don't love the United States as a government or as a political entity. Only the people, as I love all of them, even the most evil politicians in this country. I love them, but I know that I believe God is not mocked and there's going to be repercussions. The country I love the most, yes, is Russia. And you said one of your listeners asked if I don't love this country, which I don't in the way that people usually ask that question. Why do I remain? I'm only here at this time. Let's say pragmatically, there are a number of other good places in the world to live. I, of course, have my work and my family. However, you said no offense taken. Why don't I move to Russia? Actually, myself and my family are oriented and making our preparations because I believe that my family is going to have a much better life, both in the immediate and in the future in Russia. So yes, I'm oriented and actively working toward that and have gone quite a ways in that. Yeah. So no offense taken. It actually brought a smile to my face because I believe that is both my spiritual homeland and it is the people that have a society I believe that it more than any other evinces Christian principles, even though not everybody's a Christian, of course, but the way that it is governed is more Christian than any other. And your audience can do a little research on that, but your life is much better there in every way. So no offense taken. It is actually my orientation that I've done a lot toward already to be realized. Again, there are logistics involved that I am currently working on. So thank you for the question. I'm not offended at all.
Of course. No, that's great. I really appreciate that response. And more importantly, I really appreciate you coming on the show today. We've learned a ton of information. You're obviously very knowledgeable in the subject matter and very passionate about it. It's been really fun talking with you today and spending some time together.
It's been my pleasure. Your questions were great. Thank you for having me. I very much appreciated it. Be well.
Christine, it was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Until then, we are Zero Signal.
We're out.
We've hit the 0 hour. That's a wrap on this week's transmission. New episodes drop weekly, so stay tuned and don't miss the next Signal. Follow, subscribe, and spread the word. You've been listening to Zero Signal. We're out.